I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about a problem that's been a problem for a long time in American public life, the prospects for tackling the problem, the historical roots of the problem. And that problem is the issue of entitlement spending and entitlement reform. It's been on the lips of many, many politicians and public officials over the course of the last five, six, seven decades, even. But what are the what reforms have been attempted? What reforms could work? And what are the prospects for those reforms? I'm joined for that conversation today by James Capretta. Jim is senior fellow and holds the Milton Friedman Chair at the American Enterprise Institute. He is an expert on public debt, U.S. healthcare policy, and has written a very informative and deeply informed book called U.S. Healthcare Policy and Market Reforms, an Introduction, put out by AEI Press. Jim, thanks for taking the time to be with us on The American Idea.
Thank you. I'm really very pleased to be on your program, so thanks for having me.
I first encountered your work on entitlement reform on a piece that you wrote for the wonderful blog Law and Liberty, and you're talking about the prospects for entitlement reform and getting serious about it. But before we get into that conversation, as you know, our listeners are pretty historically informed people, but when we talk about the term entitlement in entitlement reform, what are we talking about, and when did those entitlements start in American history?
Great question. I think it is important to kind of see where all this got going, and because it does help understand why we are where we are. Of course, it started mostly in Europe. Germany, originally under Bismarck, started an entitlement system, and then it moved into other continental countries and eventually the UK. And the US, of course, was influenced heavily by common political currents running across the Atlantic during those years. And basically, entitlements refers first to the idea that the government will provide a benefit to a person who meets an eligibility standard in law, and that the meeting of those criteria automatically triggers the support. So there's no other discretion on the part of any other party. It just sort of says, hey, are you this old? Did you work this much? If so, you get this retirement benefit. So, or if you're working in this industry, you get this health insurance benefit that the government has mandated that that employer provide. So entitlements refers to kind of social welfare support that national governments in the early 20th century in a big way put in place to cushion some of the risks associated with urbanization and the industrial revolution. And also, you know, Bismarck especially, but then others picked it up in part to beat back what they saw would be worse elements coming from sort of the rise of socialist ideas in the mid-19th century. So both of those currents kind of fed into government saying, let's do something different. That led eventually to, you know, President Roosevelt. He was the one who really got it going with the Social Security Act, which passed in 1935. It covered, of course, retirement benefits, unemployment compensation, and other welfare support programs, which then grew in a much more substantial way with the advent of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. So that's roughly sort of the background.
The original arguments during FDR's administration in the 1930s for things like Social Security and unemployment benefits, was the argument then that we'll set up a permanent system of social welfare, particularly for people as they're older or not able to work either because they're unemployed or because they're older? Or was the idea that it was temporary relief? How did it get started in America?
Well, part of it was temporary relief, but part of it was intended to be permanent. So His baby, of course, the one he really wanted to make sure got going and became permanent. He was, of course, a brilliant political operator. He really understood politics in a great way in terms of how to make arguments and also put into law things that have enduring impact. Whether you agree with it or not, he was a pretty skilled tactician at that level. And on the temporary programs, unemployment compensation, of course, is intended to be that. It would kind of a Keynesian idea of providing cash support when there's high unemployment, which then would recede when people went back to work. So that was a big one and is still in place today. Welfare support, AFDC originally, aid to families with dependent children, came out of that same law. And that was also supposed to be temporary, but of course, for many families, welfare became sort of a permanent condition. So it didn't quite work out the way I think the original architects intended. Social Security was different. It was really based on the idea that there's a myopia associated with planning for retirement, that people can't really, especially if they're struggling financially, it's hard for them to plan their own financial security. And then there was really more of an argument, frankly, of industrialization and the kind of individualization and less family support networks forming because people moved more for jobs, there was more urbanization, and the risks of being kind of isolated in old age were higher, according to the theorists. And you needed a government program to fight against myopia and also to just provide for the fact that we were going to be much more of a atomized kind of community with individual people trying to take care of their own retirement.
Right. Obviously, since it got started, Social Security, unemployment benefits, the amount that it consumes of the federal budget has grown fairly dramatically. But in those early years, from the mid-30s to the mid-60s, before we're right at the cusp of getting programs like Medicare and Medicaid, how large, as a part of the federal government's budget, was something like Social Security?
Right. That's a great question. You know, because I like to be accurate, I'm not going to be able to pinpoint the exact number, but I'll describe it qualitatively and give you a sense. Right now, we're at about 4 to 5% of GDP just on Social Security, and it's going to go up to 6 or so. So it's a big program when you think of 6 percentage points of GDP, going to this program. At the inception, of course, there was much smaller eligibility and the benefits were much lower. But one of the important points about this is, which your question kind of gets at, is that in the 50s and 60s in particular, Congress felt like, hey, things are going great. We're going to be a growing, especially population-wise, a big booming country for the foreseeable future. We can expand what we're going to offer to folks on Social Security immediately and then pay for it gradually over time because of it's a pay-as-you-go system. So they upped the benefits with large benefit increases in the 50s and 60s that then really came back to bite the fiscal situation in the 70s and 80s because things turned. And that was a big problem. So, when it was like 1 or 2% of GDP, they thought they could really up the number and have no problem. But they ended up with a problem, 20 and 30 and 40 years later.
For some of our younger listeners who are not maybe in the Social Security system or not approaching that age, might be wondering, how does the system actually work?
That's another good question. Well, it's a complex, pretty opaque program, which I think is one of its major flaws. So, everybody who's in it kind of scratches their head a little bit and says, well, how do they calculate, what do I get out of it, right? And there is a relationship between what you put in and what you get out, but it's not as direct and clear as you might think. So they look at your career and they take your 35 highest earnings years. So if you work 40 years, they throw out the lowest 5 and they take your highest 35. They average those and get a sort of a monthly amount, average monthly amount, which they bring to current terms through an indexing, complicated indexing system. And then they apply sort of a bracket formula to it, which rewards low wage earners more than high wage earners. So the first tranche of earnings, you get 90% return on it in your retirement benefit. And then it goes down to 32 for the second tranche, and then 15% for the highest. So it's a progressive benefit formula that is weighted really toward lower income, lower wage people. And then there is a spousal benefit associated with it. And there's also a survivor benefit for the circumstance when a worker is deceased and a family member was dependent on that income. So they have, you know, it's a complicated set of arrangements, but they put it under the heading of what they call social insurance, meaning in effect that it's retirement insurance, but with some social design and social welfare aspects to it, with these other additional features, which are not a strict one-to-one ratio to what you put in.
Yeah, I think some people had the impression that maybe when it was started, and maybe that's true or maybe it's not true, that the idea was that government would take certain percentage of your wage in taxes, in a Social Security tax, put it in an account for you, and then that account would grow. And then when you retire, you would receive payments off of that account. That's kind of, that is to some extent the common perception of Social Security. I paid into it, I'm getting out of it. Is that accurate? Or is that
no,
what it was and it is not now?
It's not accurate programmatically, but it might be somewhat accurate politically, in the sense that when FDR set it up, he knew what he was doing, right? He said, okay, let's create a trust fund, call it a trust fund, and that has some importance, which I'll mention in a second. And then put, you know, all the receipts that are brought in on a pay-as-you-go basis go into it. And then, you know, the other part of it is to say, where do the receipts come from? They're, of course, withdrawn from everybody's, you know, biweekly or monthly paycheck. So you see it taken out. They don't call it Social Security, but it's called FICA, you know, Federal Insurance Contribution Act. Everybody knows what it's for. It's for Social Security and Medicare. So it does have the feel of what you just described. I'm paying into the system through my own payments. It does definitely come out of my pay, and I'm going to get something out of it in retirement. As we already described, the benefit formula is not that direct, though. Moreover, the trust fund is pay-as-you-go, so it's not like they took your money and invested it. You know, it's just in a big pool, and whatever you're paying in, you and I are paying in now, that just goes out the door to meet current beneficiaries' benefits. And then when we come around to our retirement, you know, the workers who are behind us age-wise are going to be paying for our benefits. So it's pay as you go in that sense. FDR knew exactly, though, the politics of how this would transpire. He understood very well. He said, well, I set this thing up, it's going to be very difficult politically for any politician to come along and say, hey, this makes no sense, let me change it. Because he knew that that connection between payroll withdrawal, a trust fund, and then benefits in retirement would be so powerful politically, it'd be very tough to adjust.
And then, of course, as we get to the Great Society, I'm thinking of the mid-1960s, 1964, 1965, as you mentioned, we get the addition onto Social Security of Medicare and Medicaid. Talk about that moment in American history and what was added to American entitlements.
Yeah. So, you know, the to understand Medicare and Medicaid, it's important to go back a little bit in time to just after FDR's presidency. Vice President Harry Truman becomes president after FDR's death in 1945, and he always believed, and many people associated with the New Deal always believed, there was one missing element, which was healthcare. There was a social welfare aspect to what was going on in Europe that they felt America was being left behind on, which was a big healthcare, nationalized healthcare system. Of course, the UK adopted the National Health Service in 1946. So during this moment, Harry Truman said, let's do a national health system in the United States. It famously fell short. The AMA opposed it, physician community opposed it, and Republicans opposed it. And Republicans won the Congress in the midterm election in 1946. And so once that happened, it kind of was set aside. Okay. Now, the Democrats never kind of sat by and said, well, what are we going to, you know, they didn't like that. They said, we need to do something, because there were a lot of people who are having trouble accessing what was becoming more valuable health interventions. Remember, in the early 20th century, healthcare didn't do that much for you. But by 1920, 1930, you know, anesthesia was available and some early cancer treatments were coming online. Chemotherapy and radiological treatments were coming on for cancer. And, you know, people wanted to be able to stay in a hospital if they needed a surgery that someone tells them would actually help them, you know, get their heart to work better. So people wanted healthcare insurance by mid-century, but it took the Democrats till, you know, the Kennedy and then Johnson administrations to really push forward on Medicare. And their insight there was that Social Security had proved so popular as a retirement program, they would model the healthcare program instead of being sort of for everybody nationally, they'd start with a retirement healthcare program modeled on Social Security and essentially a supplement to Social Security, and they called it Medicare. Add more to the payroll tax, and then also create a premium payment with the government subsidizing a portion of the coverage. So it was a more of a mixed model, but in the eyes of the public, it really was an extension of Social Security, and therefore it took. It got passed in the Congress in 65, which had a very heavy Democratic majority in that year. And then as an afterthought, really, they did Medicaid, which was a lower income program run through the states. There were already many states running low income health insurance programs. They essentially cobbled them together into a national structure and called it Medicaid with some federal money going to the states. It was very much an afterthought, though, not really highlighted in the debate, but, you know, got into the law, and here we are, went off to the races.
When do we start seeing people, prominent people, arguing for entitlement reform? We have critics, obviously, and opponents of Social Security, as you mentioned, in the 1930s. We have opponents of Medicare in the 1960s, but of course they're defeated. So we have these two pillars, among others, of entitlements in the United States. When do we start seeing the first calls for entitlement reform, and what are people calling for?
Yeah, so really by the late 1970s, more mid-70s, it would become clear that a major, major shift had occurred in the mid-60s. That is, first of all, inflation took off. Okay, so the national macroeconomic environment changed rather dramatically. Growth slowed, inflation went up. So there was sort of this stagflation period for a good decade or so that was very disruptive to American life. And secondly, and it also shook our confidence that, hey, we're going to be able to afford all this stuff. And secondly, the big, 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 big one was the demographic shift that the baby boom ended. And, you know, as that shifted, the projections of, you know, perpetually growing workforce that could pay for all this really vanished. So by the late 70s, everybody was saying, whoa, 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 especially the actuaries working in Social Security and Medicare. They started sending warnings into the Congress and to the executive branch. Hey, the numbers don't add up anymore. And that forced a reckoning and a political conversation around what to do. And so reforms really began in mid-70s. A big, big law change occurred in 1977. Of course, a very famous Social Security reform occurred in 1983. All during those years, Medicare was adjusted multiple, multiple times to try to get it more under control fiscally. So I would say it really began right around in that period. I would also note another thing, which is underlying all of this has been something that the listeners are probably interested in, and it's relevant to the sort of general feel of this topic, which is that there was always a concern, and it has played out very, very much according to the fears, was that the introduction of such major benefit programs with this legal entitlement kind of feature to it would change the nature of American politics in certain ways too. That this dependence on these big programs changes a little bit the relationship between the electorate and the government and their elected leaders and how people come into the electoral process. What are they looking for? What are they asking for? And what are they thinking about? And a lot of it has now been, you know, you just look at elections in the last 30, 40 years, a lot of elections are, he's going to take away your Social Security or, you know, whatever. And so there's a lot of intensity around those being political hot potatoes in a certain way.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
When we see some of these reform attempts, it's interesting, right? As you mentioned, the 1980s, to try and slow the rate of spending, not really cuts, but perhaps slowing the rate of increase, one might say. We get reform arguments from both sides of the political spectrum, the right and the left. Where does that debate, I'm thinking of the Clinton administration in the 1990s, where does that debate move during that time period and then into the George W. Bush presidency?
Yeah. Well, first of all, in the Clinton presidency, they, you know, in the second term, I think there was really a belief, and maybe the president himself kind of led that impression out there in amongst his own people inside the administration and in the electorate, that he wanted to do entitlement reform, that there were some aspects of the entitlement system that he thought he might uniquely be in a position to fix, Social Security being one. Their idea was to invest the trust funds, to take some aspect of the public money coming into the trust funds, and instead of it kind of going out the door automatically, do something like Canada did, which is take this public money and create a real trust fund, in a sense, where you invested in assets that generate a real return above treasury bonds, and that could take some of the pressure off of the tax base in future years. So that was one idea. And then, of course, there was a big Medicare commission in the 1990s that almost proposed a major structural change to Medicare. But President Clinton decided very much at the last minute that he was against that idea, and eventually, and it was sort of, it died as a result of that opposition. So it was close, but didn't happen. Now, the George W. Bush administration, I have to say, first of all, that I worked in that administration. So whatever people think went wrong, you know, I'm going to be partly to blame for that. But it did two big things. One was, from the perspective of this conversation, maybe a negative, and one very much a positive that didn't come to fruition. The negative, I don't mean it in its totality. It had very good aspects to it. There was a drug benefit added to Medicare, constructed in a unique way, competitive, had a lot of good features to it, but it did expand the government subsidization of Medicare quite substantially. And so it took a structure that was already going to be drawing a lot of future resources out of the budget and kind of increased it rather than decreased it.
And that's what people call Medicare Part D?
Part D, yes, the drug benefit, Medicare Part D. It was added in 2003. Now, President Bush did not want that to happen, just to be fair to him. He really pushed hard and wanted to do bigger reforms in addition to prescription drug benefit, but he couldn't get that done. There's a lot of Republican, even opposition, to doing any kind of controversial reforms. And so they ended up with the goodies and not the difficult stuff. They ended up with the drug benefit, but not much reform. On the other hand, President Bush did follow through and push forward a very major and would have been a great reform for Social Security, introducing voluntary accounts into it, taking some of this opaque nature that we talked about right from the beginning and turning it into something where it really would be a direct connection between what you paid in and what you were able to draw out in retirement. Moreover, it would be individually invested, not collectively invested. And so whatever returns came would go directly to you as an individual, not just to the larger pool. So he introduced this idea of voluntary personal accounts and made other changes to the program, proposed other changes to the program that would have made it permanently solvent. And if that had passed in 2005, as he had recommended, we'd be in much, much better shape today.
That begs the question, what kind of shape are we in today with respect to entitlements?
It's about as bad as it's ever been, I'm sorry to say, yeah.
I mean, you do hear people say colloquially, social, and you hear young people say this sometimes, my college students that I'm teaching, I'm not sure if I can count on Social Security. I hear it's going bankrupt. What is the state today?
Well, basically, there's enough revenue projected to come in over the next several decades to pay about 75% of what's been promised. So there's a big adjustment that's forthcoming one way or another. It doesn't have enough revenue in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, and 60s to cover all the current law benefit promises. And it's about 25% of those promises are not covered by the expected payroll tax collections. So this pay-as-you-go system has gotten out of whack, as we already described, because of demographics, which are, by the way, becoming more, even more adverse in a certain way than people thought, and even now in the last 10 years, because of just the imbalance of, you know, how big families are relative to the size of the elderly population. So the demographics of it are getting worse, and, you know, they're going to have to make an adjustment, and that adjustment just hasn't been made. And so we've procrastinated for so long that it's gotten to a pretty sizable amount, about 25% of the current structure is not covered. That doesn't mean it's going to be zero, though. So I think when everybody says, I'm not going to get anything out of it, that's not going to be the case. And by the way, I don't think Congress is ever going to just say all these benefit promises we're going to get rid of. I don't think that's going to happen either. They probably end up borrowing the money rather than just cutting the benefits. So the concern not is not so much on my part that we're going to cut everybody's benefits. My concern is that we're just going to wave a magic wand and say, well, the benefits are going to keep going. Let's just keep borrowing the money. That's, I think, the collective fiscal problem that we have.
Yeah. And because, of course, for our listeners, and maybe it's obvious, but the problem that you're talking about demographically is a smaller number of young people working or working through sort of to age 65, people retiring at age 65, and then living quite a long time on Social Security and programs like Medicare.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, maybe I was jumping through that a little too quickly. So your explanation is right.
Well, all right then. In your piece that you wrote, you talk about the idea that it's reform, however, is not impossible. That serious steps could be taken if there were the political will to do that. And you talk about it on both sides of the equation, revenue side and cost side. I think our listeners will be wondering right now that you've painted an important historical picture, but a gloomy prospect for the future. But what, in your opinion, can actually be done?
Yeah, I think Social Security is a relatively straightforward mathematical proposition. In other words, the dimensions of the problem are pretty clear. You can put them down on a piece of paper and see how big the problem is and then say, okay, Democrats, you know, are you willing to make some adjustments on the benefit side? Republicans, are you willing to do anything on the revenue side? If the answer is to both of those is yes, then okay, we can talk. And then I think on the benefit side, most likely the political system will probably gravitate towards saying, you know, if you're doing well in this country, you had high wage jobs, you don't necessarily need as much Social Security as we've promised you. So try to take down the benefit. It's already progressive, but make it even flatter in the sense of, yes, you did pay in at up to, you know, $175,000, $180,000 a year in wages. But you know what? That last $50,000 of wages you earned, you're not going to get very much out of it. Instead of 15% return, you're going to get a 5% return. So that was one of President Bush's ideas, progressive. Make the formula even more progressive over time, okay? At the same time, you could also maybe help the people who are in poverty in old age a little bit, you know, the very old. Do something for people 85 and older. I think in some ways, if you make the safety net stronger, and bring down the excessive, what I view are still excessive Social Security benefits for people on the high end, I think you get more of a flatter benefit that's also more affordable. And then you might have to just raise the payroll tax a little bit. It's 12.4 combined today. You know, is it the end of the world to make it 13.4? My own judgment is I think our economy is robust and strong enough to handle it. I wouldn't want that. I'd rather we did it all on the benefit side. But to get a deal with the Democrats, you know, you're going to have to give a little bit. This is not something Republicans have shown much ability to do on their own. So those are the dimensions of, I think, where a lot of the money could be saved.
If it's not, your suggestion is there won't be the political will to make cuts in benefits or to raise taxes to cover the additional benefits. Your fear is that we'll see even more borrowing. I think our listeners would be very interested to know what magnitude of borrowing are you talking about, particularly since we have a national debt that's now sort of careening toward about $40 trillion.
Yeah. So basically, I like to do it relative to the size of the economy because the numbers start to get so big you can't kind of get your mind around them a little bit. But right now we have debt at the national government level, at the federal level, of roughly equal to the size of the national economy, roughly, you know, as you sort of said, you know, a little over $30 trillion, or approaching $30 trillion on a net basis. So it's a big number. 100% of GDP already has been borrowed, and by mid-century, 30 years from now, it could be well over 150% of GDP. Okay, and it will be at that level if. When we get to the point where Social Security is run out of money, if Congress then says, you know what, we'll pay for these benefits that are not covered by the trust fund by borrowing more money until we can come up with a fix. And we'll just keep borrowing and allowing the trust fund to spend, and we'll pay it back later, you know, somehow, some way. If Congress does that, then, you know, we're headed toward 150% of GDP and eventually 200% of GDP. In another two or three decades after that. So it's on a very steep trajectory, and it's driven in part by net interest. That is, once you get to a tipping point, so to speak, you know, the thing gets so big, the amount of debt service payments you got to pay every year just to pay back, you know, people are holding your debt instruments, you owe them interest, you got to keep paying that interest. And that interest just comes out of the tax base and you don't get anything for it. Just the bondholders get it. And all the other stuff the government does has to be covered with other revenue. You just don't have enough. So it kind of compounds from there and gets worse. And the hole goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And pretty soon you're looking up and you're saying, I can't get out of this hole. So that's the concern. And that's sort of, we're close to that at this point.
Yeah, I think our listeners would be interested. I know it's a guess because it relies on actuarial projections and everything else, but I think our listeners would be interested to know where it's 2025 right now. What's the year that people are saying Social Security runs out of the money to pay 100% of the promised benefits?
I believe it's 20 in the last. They do a trustees report every year, and they did one a couple months ago, and I think the date was 2034.
So really only 9 years from now.
Yeah, yeah. So it's coming. And Medicare, I think, was 2033. So for hospital insurance, which is the trust fund that's like Social Security. Both of those programs are not fully financed. And, you know, what's a big issue here is that neither party seems to have the kind of political oomph to kind of push through their own vision of this. You know, they don't have enough self-confidence or wherewithal to kind of carry, you know, propose it and carry it through despite all the, you know, beatings they're going to take along the way. Neither party's offering much. So there's
your suggestion is interesting. It's hard to see what the political incentives are for proposing reform on either side in the current situation. I'm wondering, of course, America in some ways is not unique in the industrialized democratic world with the problem, for example, a demographic problem that we face. Are other countries facing the same kind of entitlement crisis?
Yes. If you look at Germany, if you look at France, You look at the UK, and you look at several other smaller countries. Spain, of course, is very much in this boat. Italy, I'll talk about Italy in a second, but yeah, there's some big countries in Europe that are very much Japan, another West, you know, kind of a democracy, liberal democracy in the same boat. They've all done sort of the same thing, which is they promised big pay-as-you-go retirement benefits that are becoming very difficult to handle because of the demographic changes that are underway, not just in the United States, but in every developed country. So, you know, some of these countries have very, very low birth rates and even below what the United States has, which means it's going to be hard to have a sizable enough workforce absent large-scale immigration. So you're going to have real difficulty paying for what's already been promised in several of these big countries, and they're very much in the same boat. Funny enough, some countries that were even worse off 25 and 30 years ago, Italy being a good example, Sweden, actually have pushed through some interesting reforms. There's some reforms.
Yeah, so what are they doing?
Yeah, they've gone to a model which is, I think, really important, which is a model where there's more personalization and transparency and less opacity around these retirement benefits. So President Roosevelt said, you know, you're going to have your Social Security, it's going to be in a trust fund, and you're going to get it in retirement. These countries, a couple of them, have done account systems where it really is true what you get out is what you put in. And so there's much more of a direct connection between your labor supply incentive, the more you earn, by the way, the more you get out. And also in Sweden, you invest it too. And so personalizing it a little bit more, it's hard to do, you know, and the people, oh, it's privatization, this and that, and, you know, the other thing. But personalization changes the political dynamic and makes it more affordable because it says to people, what you get in out is what you pay in. If you want to pay in more, you know, maybe we could do that, but it's just only going to be, you know, less things that you can pay for out of your non-retirement money. And so I think that that connection between the benefits and what the person paid in is important. It also gives agency to the people. Right now, there's such just I'm relying on Social Security. I'm waiting for it. I'm relying on it. I don't know what it is. I don't know how it's calculated, but I need it. I don't think that's good. I think it's much better when people know what's going to come out based on what they put in and have the proper incentives to handle their life's affairs accordingly.
As Jim Capretta looks at the entitlement situation in the United States, how hopeful are you or how pessimistic are you about the possibility of serious entitlement reform along the lines of what you mentioned Sweden and Italy have done?
Optimistic, I would say. I'm, you know, our politics are very not ideal from my perspective in these recent years, and so I'm not feeling very good about the kinds of possible leadership, you know, actions that might be taken in the short term. But I am always been very confident about the country as a self-correcting, you know, machine in a certain way, that when things get off track, it has a pretty good capacity to get back on track. It takes the time sometimes, but, you know, a couple election cycles where, hey, you know, nobody's doing anything and Social Security literally is about to go, you know, under in terms of the trust fund and nobody's doing anything about it. You might actually get candidates who can make some headway by saying these other people haven't done a good job. You know, so new leadership, people kind of coming forward with energy around trying to do things, not to make people less secure, actually to make people more secure. So, you know, these systems are big and complicated and they can be fixed in ways that are less costly and also provide a better protection on the bottom end. You could probably do both at the same time.
Well, that has serious, thoughtful, maybe ultimately hopeful estimation of where we are. James Capretta, the American Enterprise Institute, author of the book U.S. Health Policy and Market Reforms. Thank you for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, Remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.